This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the year with our series Last Laughs, featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the past year. 1 year ago, I spoke to Mort Saul on the 50th anniversary of his first performance at the San Francisco nightclub The Hungry Eye. That night, a new kind of comedy was born, topical and conversational. As the critic Francis Davis wrote, quote, Saul was the most innovative comedian to gain access to a mass audience in the comedy happy 50s. Lenny Bruce was still doing shtick when Saul began walking on stage with a newspaper, extemporaneously riffing on the headlines. A cool jazz buff, Saul derived from musicians not only his timing, but also their habit of traveling light, schnooky dialects, and comic personas like the ones Bruce was still hiding behind, would have been excess baggage for Saul, who spoke to audiences in his natural voice, unquote. Saul was the first comic to make a live recording, the first to do college concerts, to speak at the National Press Club, or to be on the cover of Time magazine. Most of today's political and topical comics owe something to Mort Saul. He's still performing. Before we hear from him, let's listen to an excerpt of his album A Way of Life, recorded in 1960, the same year he was on the cover of Time.
I want to read you part of the San Francisco Chronicle, which I have here. And there's a couple of interesting things happening you might be interested in, having to do with Billy Graham, who called me an atheist. Do you know about this? Yeah, he called me an atheist, which is not true. And as I've pointed out in the past, very few people are really atheists, you know. And Billy Graham, it's just that I'm of another faith than Billy Graham. And almost everybody is, I find, upon inspection. So, Zen Buddhism. So, the club is supposed to be empty. The owners were worried because of this high holiday. So did I tell you about that? That's what I kept saying. So it has to do with ethnic groups, which I want to discuss after a while. Right? So anyway, now, so I get back to that. So this gets better. So then he said I'm an atheist, and I pointed out I'm not, and the most people past college age are not really atheists because it's too hard to be in society, for one thing, and because you don't get any days off. That's been my big thing. Thank you. If you're an agnostic, you don't know whether you get them off or not. That's it. Monday. This is really weird. So then he attacked me, and Billy Graham is in Melbourne, Australia, saving Melbourne. That's his big thing there, save cities. And I don't doubt that. There's sincerity involved. It's just that, you know, if you really wanted a challenge, you could go to Vegas. Wouldn't that be great? Saving, well, anyway, thank you. So now, to get back to
Mort Saul told me that 50 years ago, he started to click with his audience when he took an anti-authority position.
The blacklist was on then. Not that it isn't on now. And it was the Russians were provoking us, you know, at every turn in Berlin and all. And I pointed out to the audience that every time the Russians threw an American in jail, we would throw an American in jail to show them they can't get away with it. And I found the oppressed majority, as Adlai Stevenson pointed out, which were the Democrats, who were all around and thought that it was the conformist 50s and they weren't welcome. But a lot of this sounds innocuous now, you know, like General Motors might become resentful and cut the government off without a cent. See, there wasn't a Ralph Nader then, and there weren't any kids, you know. And everybody remembers what they wanted to. People remembered the political stuff. Woody Allen, whom I saw Sunday, said to me he remembered all the stuff about men and women. I used to get up and, you know, quote Shaw, who said, a woman who demands her equality renounces her superiority, and a lot of Freud. And so it was, don't be ashamed to be intellectually curious. That's what it was about.
So before you performed at the Hungry Eye, had you performed anyplace else before?
Yeah, in Los Angeles. I was trying to get started for about 2 years, very unsuccessfully.
What were you doing before when you were in L.A.?
Oh, imitations of movie stars and anti-authoritarian stuff about people and policemen, mostly about being a misfit in society, which, of course, makes you everybody. So there was no success here. The city was unconscious. May still be.
Were you doing
as far as they,
were you doing James Cagney impressions like every other comic?
No. It was way out stuff. You know, the cadence of political people and the president, and also the sense of what they said, more than an impression. I mean, in the sense. Well, let me give you an example. Here was Johnson. Later, I did this, expanding the war. And the way he would do it, as he established a draft and a democracy, he said, you know, it would be wonderful if the world was at peace. It would be wonderful if other countries wanted peace as much as we do. Unfortunately, they don't. Therefore, I'm sending a truck to pick up your brother in the morning. That was basically what, you know. So it was kind of looking in and saying, where are we, and does anybody else feel this way? Which is what a real performer ought to do. Does anybody else feel this way? I had the misfortune of seeing Al Franken in New York, which was presented to me as political satire. And instead of taking a swing at the mighty, he's basically lifting his leg on them. And that shows you how the franchise has degenerated. I kicked the door down hoping somebody would follow me, and we're living in a day and age where Michael Moore and Madonna are endorsing General Clark. How would you approach that as a joke? It would mean, basically, and I doubt the comedians can do this today, that they see it. You know, the opportunity with this administration is so rich as an example, and where are the comedians? I mean, it's so rich. Diane Sawyer is sitting there the other night saying to Bush, what papers do you read? And the president says, I don't read papers. I've got people working for me that know everything. He doesn't read papers. I mean, you know, it's like my conversation with him when he said, you've got to fight the war on terror. Are you ready to make the sacrifices? And I said, I don't know. I'm pretty exhausted from fighting communism with your father. And he said to me, well, I don't like it. It's a dirty job, but that's what you elected me to do. And, of course, I was tempted to say, we didn't elect you that much. But I knew him when he was the governor.
Well, you know, while we're on the subject, what about, say, Bill Maher, who does a lot of political comedy on television?
Well, a lot of it is profane, which is not to my taste. But you can't have an elite feeling toward the people.
Do you think he does?
Yeah, I think he does. I think the skepticism toward authority, you know, this is all said from a salon at Arianna Huffington's house. And I don't have a feeling that that's a real rebellion. I'm being very candid with you.
Yeah, but you were connected to power, too. I mean, you worked for the Kennedy campaign, writing for him. And
yes, I did.
You knew and still know a lot of very powerful people.
I also sat head-to-head with Kennedy and argued about Fidel Castro and the revolution. But what I'm saying to you is what Stanley Scheinbaum said. These people have no politics. They're basically skeptical about America. They think Southerners are ignorant. They think power necessarily corrupts. They're very elite. I've listened to Maher by the hour. When I met him, he was an announcer for Steve Allen, but I don't find any, I'm being very candid with you, I don't find any generosity of the human spirit, and I don't find a lot of talent there. We might as well be straight up. That's not Will Rogers.
Anybody you do like who's working now?
Yeah, but I'll tell you, most of the people with great humor are professional men in other fields who, as a byproduct of their viewpoint, have a sense of urban irony. Example, Alexander Haig is conducting business in Russia.
Wait a minute, you think Alexander Haig's funnier than Al Franken and Bill Maher?
I'll tell you, I can give you examples.
Okay.
And you'd be hard put to give me any examples of those two guys. Not that that's your chore. But I'm a great example. I mean, Haig... Haig said he was in Russia conducting business and how capitalism was caught on. And he said, I went into the Intercontinental Hotel in Moscow, and every car that pulled up was a Mercedes 600 driven by a Russian baby boomer with a platinum blonde 20 years old on his arm and a Rolex, and they all went in and drank apple martinis. I might as well have been in Beverly Hills, except there were no communists. That's a wonderful observation. You remember when I said to him, how can you he smokes Cuban cigars. I said, how can you smoke Fidel Castro cigars? He said, well, in my place, I prefer to think of it as burning his crops to the ground.
Wait, now let me ask you. I don't know if you politically agree with Al Haig and with the Republican administrations that he worked with. Do you have to agree politically?
Of course not.
So it's funny to you whether you agree with the person or not politically.
Yeah, because he's a man with a sense of irony. You know, I can give you an example on the other side. Gene McCarthy has the best Democratic sense of humor. The great, great humorist, poet, and thinker. And those are the people that I honor and I aspire to know. But this other stuff of rebellion by the pound, I mean, what is it? Dennis Miller is telling you how wonderful Bush is. That's not political satire.
No, I'm gonna stand up for Bill Maher and Al Franken, who I think really are funny.
Well, until you hear the real thing, you will stand up for them. But eventually, okay. You know, you won't. They're not serving. I haven't said this publicly before, but I'm glad you gave me the opportunity. They're not serving the people. A political satirist's job is to draw blood. I think what we're talking about here, even when we talk straight and the role of comedy, is that I'm not a liberal. I'm a radical. The liberals, they made liberalism into a way station for people that want to cooperate with a right-wing administration and not lose their source of income and still be self-righteous, you know, have a dinner party at Barbara Streisand's but spend an equal amount of time with the guests and out in the kitchen talking to the Nicaraguans. That's really what's going on here.
What are some of the things that you said that over the years that you think drew the most blood?
Oh, my God. You know, when Kennedy was nominated, I introduced him. And I sent a wire to his father saying, you haven't lost a son, you've gained a country. You know, that kind of, but something that reflects the truth, not only the truth you find, but the truth of our fathers. And something that shows a sense of history. You know, when Jack Kennedy went to Vienna and he met, he'd only been in office 2 months, and he met Khrushchev. And he looked at this medal on his chest and he said, "What is that?" He said, "I won the Lenin Peace Prize." And Kennedy said, "Let's hope you get to keep it." We aspire to be like that. I mean, you know, and that doesn't mean I worshiped them. I had plenty of arguments with them. But those guys could give you 15 rounds.
My guest is Mort Saul. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mort Saul. In the 50s, he created a new kind of comedy, riffing off the headlines instead of telling one-liners. Joseph Kennedy, JFK's father, asked you to write for John Kennedy's presidential campaign.
That's right.
And you agreed to do it. Uh-huh. What did you write for him that he used?
Oh, I can give you some examples.
Good.
It was a lot of trouble about being a Catholic then. You're not old enough to remember that. But that was a bad word to run for high office. So I gave him, they come in and they say, are you going to take your orders from the Pope? And he says, it's not the hereafter that's bothering me, but November 4th is driving me out of my mind. And when he went out there at the press conference and May Craig from the Portland Maine paper said, what are you doing for women? And he said, not enough, I'm sure. Which is, he had the quality to do it, though, you know? He had the moral authority. And he and I used to argue all the time because I was a friend of Adlai Stevenson.
Are there things you wrote for Kennedy that he didn't use that you remember and wish he had used?
Yeah. I did a lot of stuff about Eisenhower for him. Playing golf. I said Eisenhower had hired Stevenson to write a foreign policy speech, which is true, but he couldn't use it because of the language barrier. It was in English. And he said, I can't say that about him. And William O. Douglas, remember Justice Douglas?
Uh-huh.
Douglas was there. He said to Kennedy, listen, if you're going to be Stan Kenton. Don't try and be Lawrence Welk. He's better at it. That's all true, you know? Who could come up with that? There was great stuff. Yeah, I was, you can tell a lot about the guys about which humor they'll use and which that they get. The really heavyweight guys are never offended.
Now, you're actually, instance, you're, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, Richard Nixon said to me, you got a chance to be Will Rogers, but you have to remember to keep a blowtorch under my behind as well as Jack Kennedy's. Even-handed.
Wait, you already have a blowtorch under his behind.
Well, he was drinking at the time.
Oh.
So, but he's the smartest guy I ever met in the office, by the way.
Oh, yeah? Did you write
brilliant.
For him, too? Would you?
No, I did not. But I worked for Reagan, who was a personal friend of mine.
So whether you agree with somebody's politics or not, if you like them personally, you'll write for them?
Yeah, you'd do some jokes. At least Reagan had a sense of humor. This guy has no sense of humor, unless what he's doing now
is an example. President Bush?
Yeah. Uh-huh. He has no sense of humor. I think he knows it, too. I gave him a gag. He asked me, when he was governor of Texas, if he should allow prayer by the student body at the football games. And I said, it depends how far behind you are. And he wasn't sure.
I see.
Yeah. His father has a great sense of humor, uh-huh. by the way. And the old man said to me at the White House, he asked me when I got my invitation to come to a dinner there. Mm-hmm. And I told him it had taken 4 weeks for the letter to get to California. And he said, that's absurd. And I said, how are you going to get these guys in line? Are you going to fire everybody in the post office? He said, no, I'm going to keep them on, but I'm going to mail them their checks. He's very intellectual, but he doesn't want that out, you know. So is Estes Kefauver.
Are you writing for candidates now?
No, not currently. I worked for Bill Bradley. I wrote some stuff for him. I found him pretty cautious.
In terms of what kind of humor he'd use?
He's aloof. Well, he's aloof in general. Uh-huh. The most memorable things Gore has said is since he left office.
What strikes you as most memorable?
The speech about the Patriot Act, what it's costing America. But if I were writing for somebody now, as an example, you'd say, you're writing for a Democrat now, you'd say John Ashcroft's first act in his office was to come in and cover up the bare breasts of justice out in the hall. And that's the last time justice exposed herself in the Bush administration. That's what I would say. And then you're off. You're off to the races. It's not a good sign that that they don't have any humor. And on the other hand, the other night at this, I was at a dinner in New York, and Lieberman was there, and he quoted an old gag of mine, which is reworked Mark Twain. You know that if you're drowning 20 feet from shore, Kissinger will throw you a 15-foot rope, and Nixon will point out that they met you more than halfway. That's the, you can trot out a lot of the old stuff. You know, you remember when Twain argues with his wife and she says, you'll never amount to anything. He said, well, I can always be a bad example to others. That's great American humor. That's not mean-spirited. That's not a comedian getting up and saying that the president is mindless. I mean, look at an example here. You're talking to me about Al Franken and Bill Maher and all that. What have they ever said about Cheney? I mean, wouldn't it be possible, without being intellectual, to say that Cheney is the only one covered by Bush's health plan? Or that when he dated Lynn Cheney, whom he dated, in 1952 at the University of Wyoming, that he haltingly and shyly says to her, if you're free Friday, would you like to meet me at a secret underground undisclosed location? But you've got to have a point of view to do it. Otherwise, you're stealing the money. You've either got wit, or you can identify with the human heart, or you're Jackie Gleason, that you can do something. I mean, look, you don't have to be an intellectual. You look back, of course you've seen The Honeymooners, Terry,
sure,
right?
Sure, yes.
Well, look at that. That's built as well as Shakespeare. He's always got a scheme. Nobody believes in it. His wife is the first to tell him he's crazy. When he falls on his face, who comes in there and picks him up, dusts him off, and kisses him? His wife. Why do we like it? It's about something. And when somebody says to you, that's too intellectual for me, it means they don't want to work through the fact that they're they're stealing the money. They're not up to it.
Mort Saul, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I'll see you in Philadelphia.
Hope so.
So long.
Mort Saul recorded 1 year ago. In January, he'll perform in three places in Florida, Sarasota, Naples, and West Palm Beach. Our end-of-the-year series, Last Laughs, continues in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.